fundamentally, like AI can just not replace my pattern recognition of deals. Yeah. You know, having looked at tens of thousands of deals now over, you know, 6 year period, I've just built up stuff that I know I like, and I can try to prompt and fine tune the thing to kind of do the thing I want. But welcome back to the Ignite podcast. We appreciate you tuning in with us today. We're delighted to have Natarajh Sindam on the program. He is the host of the Startup Project. He's a venture partner in Incisive Ventures, who's Martin, the partner there, was on the podcast, I think episode 7. Natarajh and I go way back. We worked at Microsoft together. We were in an angel investing club there together. Natarajh was there almost at the inception of Team Ignite, which is pretty exciting. And I've also been on his podcast, I think, just a little bit ago. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, great being here, Brian. And you missed that I'm also a product manager at Microsoft.
The main Yeah. Amongst all the other things that you do, you also are a PM at Microsoft. But yeah, would love to get an intro from you for the audience.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in a small town in South India, and then did my college in India. I did undergrad in computer science and master's in maths. And then, so this was in Goa, which is a pretty popular destination for a lot of foreign tourists coming in to India. And then I was hired by this company called Epic Systems, which is a Madison, Wisconsin-based tech company.
That'd be probably one of the bigger software Midwest software companies, right?
It is actually the largest healthcare, electronic healthcare record company.
Yeah, EMR.
EHR, popularly referred to. And so I went from growing up in South India and sort of being in this hot climate to freezing temperatures in Madison, Wisconsin. Worked there as a software, full stack software engineer for over 3 years. Did a lot of interesting product development. One of the interesting things at Epic that we had was we had the opportunity to go and observe our customers. So that means we can travel to like really large healthcare organizations. So I went to like Stanford Health, CVS, Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic. So you name it, we're all customers of Epic, and we had a chance to go and observe how, you know, our product is being used in live and sort of develop and adjust our product. And that was a great experience of, you know, understanding your customer and how it affects, you know, product development. Been there for a while, and then moved to Microsoft. At Microsoft, been working mostly on cloud technologies, worked on Azure Stack, which is this, you know, hybrid cloud offering where you take sort of, if you think Azure as an operating system, you take that and deploy it on an on-premise customer data center. And so that when customer can seamlessly work with on-premise data centers and their cloud counterparts. So that was a big problem that we were trying to solve. Was also
That's like AWS Outposts, right? Like they're...
Yes.
Okay. Yes, what's the name of it at Azure?
Azure Stack.
Stack, okay, yeah.
And then right now I'm working at Azure Files, which is essentially, you know, storing unstructured data on your in cloud, which is very relevant, you know, to what's happening in AI, because most of the data that's in the world out there is basically unstructured data. And we are creating those products so that organizations can store, you know, their unstructured data in Azure Files.
Very cool. How was the... what was the transition from Epic to Microsoft like?
Epic.
And why did it occur? Yeah. Like, what did Azure reach out? Microsoft reached out, or?
It's sort of, I don't think Microsoft reached out. I think I reached out to Microsoft. So I was working there for almost 3 years, and then sort of realized that I wanted to do different things. Working in healthcare is different, and then working in Epic is sort of different.
Yeah.
Although, like, it opened up my eyes into like how technology is being used. So, because in general, you don't see that much of technology and healthcare into you know, interaction, right?
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool to see. And when I came to US versus, I was comparing everything with, you know, sort of India and Asia. And it is also cool to see that, you know, technology is being used so actively in healthcare, from like scheduling, registration, inpatient therapy, you know, surgery, and how technology impacted. And then I wanted to be you know, at the center of where it's all happening. So my goal was sort of to move to, you know, the West Coast, either Silicon Valley or, you know, Washington. Even though Washington is not referred to as Silicon Valley.
So Silicon Forest, I think, is the name.
Yes.
And I'm, it's funny because I'm laughing because I'm from Seattle, so I know how terrible the weather is.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I think at that point I tried to find out, you know, work at different companies on the West Coast. And my plan was actually to eventually move to West Coast, San Francisco or California,
yeah,
because of the weather, because I came from sort of a hotter weather, and I eventually want to move to a place where it's similar weather. But now I think I've sort of gotten used to the Washington weather and sort of look forward to it.
It's beautiful up there. I mean, on a clear day, all the mountains, and it's just, there's no place like it. I just can't live with 272 days of overcast weather anymore. I just living in California.
Yeah,
like, so I live in shorts from about early April to early November. So about 7 months out of the year, I'm just literally living in shorts.
Yeah, that's the ideal temperature we want. But so in Washington, you have 3 or 4 months of shorts. So
yeah, maybe. Yeah, if you're lucky.
But a significant upgrade from, you know, Madison, Wisconsin.
How did you originally get into startups and venture capital? Kind of what was that transition like? And, you know, kind of the inception of startup project. What is that? And
so
how did you get into that?
I think regarding the investing side of things, it started with me investing in Indian companies. So when I first moved to Washington, some of my friends back in India were investing in starting funds to invest. This was the same time like India's...
I recall this. This is about the time we met. You were actually, I remember, specifically focused on Indian companies at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of my friends was raising a fund and he was actively investing in Indian companies, which sort of grabbed my attention at that point of time. And since, you know, investing in India is always a smaller check versus investing in the US. So I've done a bunch of investments in India and sort of in that process understood, you know, what that asset class is, how that asset class works. And in general, I was also curious about how, you know, angel investing or venture as an asset class worked. And I think I read Jason's angel investing book. I read a bunch of books, Venture Deals by, I forgot the investor name, but Venture Deals is another amazing book, which I always suggest people.
Scott Kapoor had one as well around the same time.
Yeah, Scott Kapoor, I think, came a little bit later, a couple of years after that. I read that one too. So I sort of tried to develop, you know, understanding of how this asset class works. And then started doing the same, you know, after some failures and some success in India, I then realized, hey, I mean, I'm in sort of like one of the biggest tech cities, which is Seattle. So I thought I'll focus in the space I was in, because sourcing and investing in India, even though I got started with it, it has its own set of problems. It has its own set of complications being here and doing investing. You can't meet the founders. You can't sort of create a, you know, virtual network that you sort of have to create if you want to be in this business.
Yeah.
So at some point I said, okay, I want to focus on the US and primarily, you know, Seattle and SF, where, you know, there are much bigger companies and much more, you know, as a pure opportunity wise, if you calculate the TAM, right, there's much bigger opportunity to capture.
Nice.
So then I shifted my focus into investing here, and that's why I was doing deals with, you know, different investors, and that's how I met Martin, whom you had on the podcast, and now we sort of work with him to invest in startups based in the US.
Yeah, so we tried and failed together to do a Microsoft syndicate. Whatever happened to that? Did that ever get off the ground?
Yes and no. It sort of translated into my syndicate. I think the Microsoft syndicate idea is done every generation, because Microsoft is a, you know, 40 plus year old company.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you can find every generation of Microsoft is having a syndicate. So
yeah, yeah.
In fact, Seattle, I think, is just Microsoft's syndicate divided into venture firms and accelerators in a lot of ways. Yeah, it didn't come together as much, but we, you know, the community is still growing. I think people internally are, you know, meeting and, you know, trying to, you know, are starting their journey. I think it's acting as sort of a place where they can start their journey.
Are you syndicating deals currently?
I try if there is an opportunity, but I don't actively go and seek a syndication opportunity.
Yeah. If so we're recording this in late April 24, and you know, I feel like the syndicate market's still really soft.
Yeah.
You know, I came up you know, kind of in this industry, I started angel investing 2018, 2019. I was LPing a bunch of funds, and then I started syndicating stuff in late 2020. That's around the time I started Team Ignite officially. And back then, 2021, early part of 22, I mean, you could syndicate anything, get 100K, 200K, no problem.
Yeah.
And now it feels like I struggle to get, you know, 50K and even 25K in some cases.
Yeah.
What's going on in the market there?
I mean, I was talking to Sajid, you know, Sajid from MyHLEC. He's probably lead syndicator on AngelList. And he thinks the
same. Is that how you pronounce his name? It's Sajid, not Saeed?
Yeah. I mean, Sajid is what I called him. So he didn't disagree. So I'm assuming
yeah.
that's the right pronunciation.
Shout out to Saeed. I'm going to say Saeed, but that's how I've always pronounced his name. I've never met him in person, but I've probably co-syndicated, you know, 20 deals with him over the years.
Yeah, I was just talking to him, and I think I'm about to publish his episode. He's invested in 1,300 plus deals.
1,300?
Yes.
That's insane.
1,300 plus deals. I think he's part of now 50 unicorns, I think.
Jesus.
He's running 4 venture funds. Yeah, I think the episode, I think it really came out well. I'll be publishing, I think, this weekend.
I'll definitely listen to that. That's really interesting. So shout out to MyAsia VC and, you know, the Startup Project podcast that you run. Definitely check out that episode when it drops.
Yeah, but to your question of like syndicate, I think, I mean, it was always tough to be a syndicate lead, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you experienced this. Being a syndicate lead is a thankless job, and it involves...
Yeah, there's no management fees. You're herding cats. It's lots of little 1K, 2K, 3K checks. And you're just kicking and scratching and beating people over the head with emails, trying to get them to invest. It's a tough game. It's really tough.
Yeah. I mean, you might as well go and raise a fund. I think if you, after maybe an year or two as a syndicate, I think the next logical step, you know, work
you,
with
you
the
should
fund
raise a fund as soon as you can. As soon as you have enough track record, just raise any fund. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I think you did. So I think raising the fund is an obvious next step, and just being in a syndicate game doesn't work. And for people who it's working, I see is who are running a fund and syndicating them in parallel, because you have no pressure to syndicate, you know, X amount of leads. I think those are the ones who keep on doing syndicate deals on, you know, AngelList or other platforms. But otherwise, like, yeah, it's really tough game. And there are few ways you can market a syndicate, which is, again, a nightmare. So all the stacks are up against you. Like, it has more problems than running a fund in a lot of ways. It's a good way to get started, you know, experiment. I think it has its advantages, you know, low barriers of entry, learning how deal flow works, how you can source deals. Like,
I keep going back and forth with syndicating because I still run syndicates from time to time, but it just takes so much extra time versus just wiring from a fund.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like 3 or 4x the work of just like, you know, because with each deal, we'll spend hours and hours, you know, meeting the founder, going through all the docs and writing our memo and all that stuff. But then if you syndicate, you basically just multiply that by 2 or 3x.
The big problem also, like for me, syndicating has been big negative in a sense, is not the additional hard work that you have to do, but the fact that the deal that you want to invest in, because as a syndicate lead, you sort of get a better sense of what works, or you sort of develop your own strong point of opinion, right?
And therein lies the whole problem with being an investor. And it was actually a really wise syndicate lead on AngelList that told me this. He goes, as a syndicate lead, you're actually not an investor.
Yeah.
You are basically, you're equalizing access to great deals.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people who invest in syndicates aren't sophisticated investors. No offense to anybody on Team Ignite, sorry. But what they tend to look at is like, what's the quality of the lead? Okay, do I recognize that VC? And everything else is secondary to that almost. It's like, I'm co-investing with Sequoia or, you know, whoever.
And the fact that the most investors will take a couple of years to realize how those are actually negative signals. If you're getting access of a Sequoia deal on AngelList, then that means that is something negative about it. Because why is
Why didn't Sequoia just take the entire round? Or why is it even, why did it even make its way to AngelList?
So that's
if Sequoia isn't the round.
It'll take people like a couple of years to realize that, oh, this is actually not a good signal. This is actually a bad signal.
Yeah.
And I was investing pre-seed. I still like focused on pre-seed. When in pre-seed, the investing art that you develop, the things that you think are matter based on all this data that you have seen over the years, it's hard to translate into one deal memo. You can write a great deal memo out of it, but that will not translate as a deal memo that the LP on a syndicate is looking for. So that actually is the main problem why I sort of stopped pursuing that line, I would say.
Yeah, that's definitely it's been a tough thing. So I have here in my notes that you were involved with Techstars Seattle.
Yeah, I was one of their mentors before Techstars Seattle closed down recently. But yeah, it was a great sort of a network to connect with folks in Seattle, investors, founders. And I think last couple of cohorts have actually been good. So I think their decision to close is actually, you know, not a good one considering what, you know, the quality of the companies that last two cohorts bought.
Yeah, I was reading online about why that happened. Apparently, I mean, they're trying to be more profitable, you know, running physical locations at lots of different geographies. Obviously, it's really expensive. And a lot of stuff has gone virtual, I think, post-COVID, yeah. I think, as well. So, I mean, I run all of Team Ignite from a little, you know, a little home office east of 45 minutes east of Sacramento, like in the middle of nowhere, practically, you know, but yeah. I have a fiber internet and a camera, right? So do you have any other details of like that decision-making process?
Yeah, I mean, I have the same details. I think it was mostly about, you know, making some operating cuts yeah. and sort of becoming profitable and focus on less number of areas. But I think closing Seattle didn't make sense. You know, it's probably the second, you know, highest tech talent out there, more AI companies than most places. So it didn't make sense logically, even with the logic that they've provided.
Yeah.
I think maybe they have a better network in other cities because there are a lot of smaller cities that they're trying to focus on, which don't have enough network as Seattle has. I mean, now Greater Seattle is very, very growing. It's probably like SF 10 years back. So,
yeah.
I mean, if I was running the Techstars, I wouldn't close Seattle out. Look for an alternative, and they have a cheap lease in Startup Hall, so I didn't know what's the most expensive for them was in any way. And even if like Techstars Seattle, I don't know if how their funds performance has been, but I've met really impressive founders like pre-seed before they became big in those Techstars meetings. So if they had a fund that is not outside the cohort, I think they could have done even much better is what I would say, considering, you know, they were at the core of the ecosystem.
Let's switch gears and talk about the 100 days of AI. What is that?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, with ChatGPT and OpenAI explosion, sort of everyone, you know, obviously there has been a huge buzz about, you know, AI and generative AI. Obviously AI has been here for a while and, you know, it was called machine learning before that, maybe data science, but now I think sort of ChatGPT captured that attention of everyone. So this year I was I did machine learning before, like a couple of years back, but I wanted to get more focused and sort of get to the latest of what's happening in AI and in specifically, you know, generative AI and LLM. So what I did was, you know, start this thing called 100 Days of AI, where I spend 2 to 3 hours a day on just learning AI and primarily specifically everything about LLMs. So, and every day I learn something, I write a blog post about it. So the goal was to spend 100 days of AI, spend 100 days on learning generative AI and learn about it, play with different tools, experiment, you know, create products, write code, and basically build interesting experiments. And I think that will help. I think it's partly, you know, how you can adapt in an AI place for your own career. It helps me as an investor to understand what are the upcoming tools, what are the ecosystems that we should look for, and as a professional.
You started this?
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I think I wrote 20 plus blog posts, been publishing like 5 to 6 blog posts every 2 weeks. The 100 days have been passed, but we haven't gotten to the 100 blog posts.
I love that.
Yeah, it's hard to convert a day's learning into a blog post. The writing part is actually much tougher than the learning part. It's sort of absurd.
It's this thing that always is like the last on my list, but something I really enjoy is writing articles, and I just have not had time to write anything lately.
Yeah. But it's a good forcing function, like you know, force myself to stay updated on what's happening in Gen AI. Yeah. And it also helps for us, you know, as a Azure product manager, to find opportunities for our own products. Like, how can we, you know, which are the workloads that we should focus on, where, and which are the ecosystems where all these workloads are happening. So it did give me a lot of insight, and I'm sort of continuing that for a couple more months.
How, where can people go and kind of learn more and follow that?
People can follow it on startupproject.io, thestartupproject.io. That's my website. And there's a section called 100 Days of AI. And yeah, all the blog posts are now listed there.
Love that. What is this launching checks?
Yeah, so this is something that we are launching. It's called Checks I Wrote. I think the domain name is. It's currently in sort of like alpha/beta mode testing. The goal here is we want to bring all the, and I'm doing this along with our friend Martin. We want to create a community of investors who are sharing their deals. So If Natraj has invested in, as an angel or as part of a fund, I've invested in the last five companies. I'm going to put that, put those details in the community, and the community can reach out to me and say, hey, I'm interested in this company for the next round. Can you put me in touch with them? So I think it helps more entrepreneurs, more investors to find opportunities, work and collaborate with other investors, and so that we can unlock value. So if I'm a pre-seed investor, my companies are looking for Series A, Series B, and Series C investors. And if I'm a Series A investor, I want to know all the pre-seed and seed companies. So it's a close-knit network, selection-based, sign up, sort of create a loosely exclusive network, exclusive in the only sense that they are actually active investors. Nothing beyond that is exclusive. And hopefully we'll also extend eventually to founders, but that's not has been the focus right now. The more focus is just to help the investor sort of do more deals and collaborate more deals. And that sort of helps the ecosystem in general.
Yeah. So what's the mechanism? How would I get involved, and what would I go in and do?
I think we have right now a sign up page called checksiro.com where you can, you know, enter your details and sign up. And I think the product is going to be out in next couple of days or a week in alpha. We are right now removing some bugs at this point. But yeah, everyone should be able to get access in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's interesting, the whole deal flow community thing. Yeah, you definitely email me when it comes out. I'll check it out. And, you know, I'm in all these like kind of loose affinity investor groups, right? Like I went through VC Lab, so I got those guys. And Martin's part of that group, and Ihar and those guys. And they've both been on the podcast, and we kind of share deals that way through WhatsApp or through email. Personally, I've always done, I keep an Airtable full of all the investors I meet and what they're looking for. You know, it's a simple Airtable form. And then I try to send out quality deals, only stuff that I have high conviction of, or, you know, stuff I'm personally investing in, you know, so it's like, hey, I'm actually investing in this. You should take a look. And I get lots of really quality deals that way. And there's been lots of companies out there that have tried to, I don't know, formalize this sort of deal flow network. But, you know, I think it's always this kind of loose buddy-buddy kind of system, you know?
Yeah.
And it's hard to kind of formalize that.
Yeah. And I think the attempt to scale it too large is when it fails. We don't want it to scale it big. And we also are not trying to make it a business. When you also try to make it a business, it becomes a little bit more complicated. I mean, obviously you never say never, but I think you sort of keep it lightweight, not too much work on the side of investors, and at the same time have a method to control quality. I think that's a sweet spot. It's not going to be a tool that has to be, every investor has to be, right?
Yeah.
So it is still in sort of like that experimental phase. It's we'll see how it goes and how the traction comes and how the usage will be and what's the feedback, and based on that we can iterate.
Yeah, that's interesting. So yeah, checksiro.com, check that out. How do you balance everything? I mean, you're like, you got the product, you have a full-time job, you got all this writing, podcasting, investing you're doing, which we haven't even talked about what you do at Incisive yet specifically, but like, how are you? Like, are you sleeping?
I don't know. I sleep a lot. I mean, the podcast is really only maybe 2 hours a week. Everything else is either outsourced or, someone else does it for me in terms of editing, or, you know, posting on social media, stuff like that. So the podcast really is you know, 2 hours a week, because I go through a 2 weeks per episode schedule and not a weekly episode, which
I'm doing like five a week right now. I'm all over the place.
I'm a little bit less intensive on the podcast side of things. Not as intensive as you are. So I think but otherwise, like, most of my time is at my full-time job. And for Incisive, it's, you know, depending on the week and what we are launching and what we are building and how many deals are happening, it depends, you know, 10 to 12 hours, or, you know, sometimes it might be 20 hours per week.
Yeah, two or three hours a day kind of thing, and in your spare time. Yeah. What are you doing at Incisive? Are you kind of acting as like kind of the first screen of deal flow coming in, or?
I act as a first screen. I build we build some technology behind the scenes so that we
all has Airtable automate stuff.
Screening. Yeah. Some Airtable stuff, some internal websites, so that we can have, you know, our own workflow set up.
Yeah.
And then obviously sourcing deal flows, like from our networks or.
Yeah.
Events in Seattle or in general meeting with interesting
getting
people.
The autoresponder now when I send Martin deal flow, it's like, please have them fill out the form. And I'm like, dude, Martin, I invest in this company, take a look at it. I'm not gonna send them to a form. Yeah,
I think I created it.
Yeah, everybody needs to and that's the funny thing about deal flow, right? It's kind of like, you kind of need to look at, like, I use a lot of AI. I have an AI background and I use AI a lot in my due diligence and my deal memo writing, a lot of my article writing, my podcast outlines. I use it in every like workflow imaginable. But fundamentally, I really just got to look at the deck and the team. AI can just not replace my pattern recognition of deals. Yeah. You know, having looked at tens of thousands of deals now over, you know, 6 year period, I've just built up stuff that I know I like, and I can try to prompt and fine tune the thing to kind of do the thing I want. But fundamentally, I'm still going to look at everything and just kind of yay or nay it. You know, I think, you know, maybe someday it'll be like an AI VC, you know, running this. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not big on like algorithms picking stuff, especially like AI picking a deal.
Yeah.
I think I don't know if I can, because on one startup, you make a decision based on something, and on a different startup, you make a decision based on a different factor. Like, that factor overshadows your decision making.
Yeah, like sometimes it's like, oh, amazing team, not sure if the idea will work. Sometimes it's like, oh, crazy traction, they just 4x their revenue 2 quarters in a row or 3 months in a row, whatever the metric is, and the team's like pretty good. Yeah. And like, so every startup's like this beautiful snowflake, and you have to like appreciate it for its intricacies and uniqueness.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, beautiful snowflake. Little snowflakes. So how has your philosophy changed over the years, and especially after working with Martin, somebody that's been doing this for decades?
Are you talking about like investing philosophy?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
I think working with Martin, I would say Martin has a very interesting decision framework. Like, he has a stoic way of looking at deals, and he has a certain, you know, parameters that he looks at, and he's not easily an investor who's tempted by sort of shiny things.
I get that sense from him. Yeah, I get that sense from him.
Yeah, so if you say like a lot of keywords, he's not excited, or, you know, he's not averted by it. So he's sort of like always sort of a stable hand in terms of looking at a pitch deck, and he always focuses on the 5 things that he's interested in, and he looks at it with that lens. Over the years, I think for me, you know, the philosophy of investing in a startup slightly changed, because I started from India. The way I judge Indian company, or the category that I look at an Indian startup, is very different from what I look at in the US side of things. In the US side, for pre-seed, I've sort of settle down on finding a great team in a good area. That's where if I have to like make my investing thesis into one line, that's what I would say. So even my angel investments are with Incisive, that I sort of find a great team with good or great idea. That's all it matters in pre-seed, is where I've settled down.
Kind of reminds me of an old phrase that I heard, and I haven't brought this phrase up in a long time, many years, but, you know, great team meets a great market, awesome, great success. a great team meets a bad market, not going to work out.
Yeah.
And, you know, bad team makes a great market, might be okay, might work out. What do you think of that? I don't remember who said it. Yeah.
I think I heard this somewhere too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's all really, you know, timing matters, even in bad markets.
It's another way of saying like timing really matters. Like you could have the best team with the best technology and the market's just not ready.
Yeah. I mean, we see that so many historical examples, right? Like I've heard, you know, Bill Gurley invested in two or three companies that were similar ideas like Uber, which really didn't take off, right? But Uber was at the right time, right place with the right people that could execute it, right? So, and it certainly took off. So there's like plenty of examples. Like there are mapping companies before Google Maps, which, you know, didn't really fully take off. And, you know, there are tons of examples of pretty much any successful company. I mean, even Google, right? I think it was 10th or 15th search company, and Yahoo was already a search, established search player before Google. So I think there are plenty of ways to, you know, slice it and dice it. So I sort of came back to like, if we at pre-seed level, you can't really analyze a lot of these things. At pre-seed level, you have to focus on whether you have a really, really, really good team. And I think really identifying good people and good team who can write code, I think that is sort of what I've trying to look at when I'm saying good team. There has to be one, there has to be a guy who's writing code at a pace that others are not writing. I think that is really an attractive factor for me. And whenever I'm trying to find founders, that is what I'm trying to look at. Does the founding team have someone who's an above average or even, you know, highly, you know, exceptional talent in terms of tech, and he's already in as a founder? That's a huge, huge, huge positive factor to me. And the all the other things like storytelling, sales, marketing, I think those can all be easily, not easily, but over time can be built with funding.
Yeah.
But in the initial stages, if you don't have that one good tech guy, because we are investing in tech companies, if you don't have that one good, really tech talent, I think it's not going to work out.
I absolutely agree. You got to have at least one person who's really deep technically, although technological moats are getting whittled away a bit, I think, with Gen AI. But the thing you said is really important about Google, right? The 17th search engine that came along, you know, and a lot of people passed, right, in the late 90s on that one. They're like, you know, like, why do we need another one? Right? There's already a bunch that are really successful. And I think it kind of dovetails nicely into kind of my strategy as an early stage investor, which is high volume strategy, a spray and pray. I like to say it's like more like a spray and 10x, you know, because, you know, I have lots of conflicts in my portfolio, right? Where I'm like, I'm invested in three of the same ideas in three different companies. But I'm also not hands-on. I'm not a board member, but I think that's the right strategy for early stage. If I was Series B, completely different strategy, but in the pre-seed kind of arena, you want to spread your bets.
Yeah, I agree. I think you have to take a different approach when you're pre-seed versus CDC or series. I think
look at Saeed with 1,300 investments, right?
He has
my Asia VC 1,300 conflicts with 50 unicorns, and you know that sounds impressive, but you have to also realize that he's just hitting almost an average unicorn hit rate.
Yeah,
you know, the average over time is 2 or 3%, and the average for YC is 5 or 6%. He's just hitting almost like the average. The law of large numbers.
Yeah, it kicks in.
It kicks in, right? When you have that high volume of strategy. And if you hit the index for these early stage deals, you're getting a 30 to 40% IRR.
Yeah.
Just, you know, if you run the Monte Carlo on a really large portfolio. So, you know,
the one problem I see with the scale or volume approach is, and I'm not sure, like, I haven't seen actual portfolios and, you know, evaluated them, but there's a concept of too much diversification, then you're at the end buying an index, right?
Yeah, but my point is the index is pretty freaking great.
I'm talking
as about an asset like, class. And
that's the point I'm talking. If you have bad diversification, or you know the particular lot that you're investing goes, you know, slightly under the average, you are basically doing the average S&P, not the average venture capital.
Yeah, I mean the seed asset class is 30% on average over the long term. You know, you could go buy the triple Q and get 20% or 20, even 25, yeah. Right? So you're really locking up your money for a lot longer for maybe 10 percentage points more return. But that being said, you know, I've talked to lots of folks that have high volume strategies. And this is just another, you know, another example with my Asia VC, but these folks that have high volume strategies tend to crank out like 10X funds, you know, 8X, 7X, you know, and that's, if you can do that, you're already in the top 5 or 10% of VCs.
Yeah. So you might and that just... strategy only works really as a, you know, syndicate or a angel investor, right? As a fund, you only have, well, I don't know, 35, 40 slots in your, so they start
not for Team Ignite, not for Team, we'll do a lot more than that. You know, our vision is, you know, there's, you know, 10,000 seed fundings every year, you know, pre-series A, you might call it. I don't count a seed extension. Seed extension to me is like a bridge round, but really pre-seed and seed. And, you know, our vision is to be in the top 500 or 1,000 of those every year, which would, in a standard, you know, deployment cycle of over 3 years, would mean we'd have 1,000 or 2,000 companies in a fund, which is enormous. I'm going to probably have to build new systems to do that, but that's kind of the vision.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great vision. I think you should definitely talk to Sajid
and see how he's scaling up. Yeah, I need to talk to him.
He's also doing 4 funds, by the way.
Well, I know he has his YC fund. He has another fund that's more just like standard.
He has an AI fund coming up. He is doing YC fund, and he has 2 more funds. I forgot what they exactly are focused on.
Incredible. That guy's a machine. What are you doing when you're not doing all this startup and product management stuff?
Not much, really. I mean, I'm learning something, reading books. Last couple of years, I've been going to CrossFit. That's 3 to 4 times a week. I used to be very lean. Now I'm still lean.
Put on some muscle. You know,
and definitely put on a lot of muscle.
I'm trying to do the opposite. I'm trying to like lose fat. So I've been doing intermittent fasting. Mm-hmm. So right now, I'm actually, why I have so much energy is I'm on a... I'm 24 hours into my fast practically right now.
Oh, nice.
So your body kicks into ketosis and you're just like, you get a huge burst of energy.
Yeah. Outside work, reading books, gym. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, in general chores.
Awesome. Well, let's wrap up with some rapid fires.
Sure.
What is your favorite book on technology or business or startups?
I would say Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley is a good one. It's sort of, I think I'm like a 49% positive, 51% negative type of a person. So I think it forces me to be more positive. So, and also be a little bit more, I think it also taught me about being positive some, because when you grow up in India, which is a resource constrained society, you're naturally inclined to think, you know, negative sum or, you know, zero sum. So in a resource rich society like, you know, US, you have to actually think positive sum. Not negative sum or zero sum. So I think that book really taught me about, you know, being positive sum and being an optimist. When I think investing sort of requires you to be sort of like an optimist for the long term. The other book is sort of like, has been my carrying pocketbook, even though the book is big, is this book called Super Thinking by Gabriel Weinberg and Lauren McCann. I think they're 2 professors. I forgot at which school, but it's a collection of mental models essentially. I think that's one book everyone has to read. Like if you're a product manager, if you're an investor, they've taken like the best of the mental models that you keep hearing about and sort of put it in a way that it all makes sense.
Yeah.
I think that's also a book that really helps if you are a product manager. And I think it will also help investor, and really anyone can get a lot out of that book. I think it sort of takes concepts from, you know, thinking fast and slow from, you know, Daniel Kahneman, and Charlie Munger's, you know, mental model book. I think they've taken a lot of good mental models that have really shown their power over time and sort of put them in a way that it really makes sense. And it's a very rich book, so I'm reading it very slowly. That has been my new favorite. But otherwise,
what's the name of the book again?
Super Thinking.
Super Thinking. I don't think I've heard of that.
It's a relatively new book. It's not that old.
Yeah.
But I think they've compiled mental models very, very well. I would say it is an underrated book, you know, in a lot of ways.
That's cool.
In general, I follow curiosity. I read random books. I read, like, you know, how the companies have been created books. So, for example, like I've read a book on Google Maps a couple of years back. I like reading books that I am personally interested in, not like it's because, you know, it's popular. So I generally buy books which are older and which are in some way have to be interesting to me. So for some reason I got curious about something, then I just search for this book and I buy the top three results.
Yeah.
I'm not like regularly buying just because someone suggested. Mm-hmm. I'm more like going and finding a book in a particular area.
Every time I hear of a good book, including the two you mentioned, I just add to my Goodreads, and now I have hundreds sitting there in Goodreads to read, which I'll never get to. You know, maybe I listen to a handful of them.
You can see here, like there's so many books I buy.
Yeah.
I read hardly 10 books a year.
I probably finished I got to this point where I was doing like one book a week, and now it's probably like one or two a month.
Yeah. I did that in like 2018, I think, 2018, 19. I read like 35 books. Like every day I used to sit in Starbucks and read.
Yeah.
So that year, I feel like I'm still using that knowledge.
I got to this point where I'd read so many books where books weren't interesting anymore. I had to like almost listen to podcasts to get the latest, greatest thinking, or YouTube videos. Like hear talks that were more on the, I don't know, tip of the spear of things coming out in technology and business, rather than like what people wrote about years ago or decades ago.
Yeah. I think, books are great for like some fundamental,
timeless ideas of knowledge.
Knowledge, right? Yeah. I think books are still there, great. And I feel like it's an edge if you push yourself to read books, because no one is reading anymore. People are buying for sure. I don't think they're reading it, right? It also like it's a forcing function to increase your attention span.
Yeah.
Like to sit there and sit down. So I should probably read more, but I'm not reading as much as I should be.
With AI, what do you think the whole future of SaaS and venture capital is?
With AI, I mean, I was just thinking in terms of like where the value of AI is going to be like captured, right? I think that's the most important question everyone's asking. So I think there are like four different stages or four different categories we can think of this as. The first one would be foundation models, right? Foundation models, you know, your OpenAIs, your GPTs, your Perplexity.
Yeah.
Of course, Perplexity is not a model, but, you know, all the models from Meta.
It's funny you mentioned Perplexity. I've been all of a sudden using them all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in the last
week. I
tried
for a week, and then somehow I eventually got to using GPT and Microsoft Copilot. Because I think accessibility.
Mm.
But so I would say the number one would be foundation models. Good foundation models. We are seeing generic foundation models right now. I think we'll see more specific and smaller foundational models that are, focused on specific tasks like, discovering your medicine, discovering, focused on cybersecurity, or discovering or just focused on healthcare. So we'll see, I think, smaller niche models, not necessarily smaller, but niche models more in the next couple of years. If you have to bet, you will see. I think the second one is all about, I would say there'll be a lot of companies, I think existing companies and new companies around data management and, creating data and consuming data and storing data. So it's all going to be around data infrastructure, storage and consumption. So in consumption side, you can include media companies, the Reddit, the Axel Springers of the world who are selling their data in terms of, Databricks as a company which is enabling usage of data. You can put, Azure, AWS, and all these guys in the data space. And then I think the big unlock is probably a new wave of cloud computing. I think AI is a new wave for cloud computing and storage in general. I think we've seen last couple of years, we thought that computing and storage has become a commodity. But with AI, there's a new need for both compute and storage, which now no longer a commodity, right? Because we thought it was commodity, but I think there's a new wave that is sort of pushing cloud computing. So the big winners would be, the big cloud companies because of AI adoption. The computing and storage business is going to go up. And which specific products will be interesting to see, because depending on who can serve those workloads, we'll see that. But there's also like new cloud companies will also come up here. I think we're already seeing some of those cloud companies. I forgot the name, but they're now GPU cloud companies that have come around, which I think will have their space in the market as well. Just like DigitalOcean is a smaller cloud provider, which had its opportunity among these big clouds, we'll have GPU specific clouds will also come. There's one interesting angle in the cloud is NVIDIA has this digital twin concept and its own, not metaverse, I think they use a different term, but if it's sort of like metaverse, but I forgot the exact term that they're using, which I think is a very big opportunity, which probably Meta should focus on and other companies should focus on, because AI's next frontier is robotics. And these metaverse right. that follow real world physics can generate training environments for robots that will be deployed in real world.
Yeah.
So that I think is a very big opportunity that NVIDIA is obviously very well positioned, and they have their own sort of metaverse equivalent for this purpose. And yeah. I think that's where real opportunity of metaverse in near and short term is, instead of like we hanging out in a metaverse club. I think the real use case is train systems for the real world physics by, you know, creating a digital twin of your office environment or a healthcare environment, and there you're training robots for different scenarios, and you generate data which is lacking in real world and use that to create, you know, generative AI for robots. So I think that's a big unlock in cloud as well. I think the fourth one would be again the app layer, and the app layer, I think existing companies, the growth stage companies, which were, you know, Klarna and all these companies which are almost close to profitable,
right,
not profitable yet, AI will push them over to profitability. I think that is a big trend we will see in the next couple of quarters. And this is for, I think, existing apps, but for the apps, there's an opportunity to rethink all the existing apps. And because AI allows you to sort of have intelligence as an API, you can create apps that were not possible. So, you know, Jasper AI or Copy AI, these were not possible before to create, or right. copilots, agents, like these new sort of digital software form factors, you can, if you can call that, are also possible. So there's a whole category of those, you know, which will come on the app layer. Yeah, I think those are like cool. largely four categories where all the value for AI will be captured.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I could talk to you for another hour. We'll have to have you back on the program at some point in the future.
For sure. Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me. Always great to catch up.
Yeah, likewise.